أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. أشهد أن محمد.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome once again to Islam in Focus. Today's program is the 60th in the series Sources of Islam, and to be more specific, it's the third in our new topic on abrogation. I'm your host, Rashad Mimish, and here with me is Dr. Jamal Bitawi from St. Mary's University. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Jamal.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Dr. Jamal, as we like to do to refresh our viewers' memory, could you please give us a summary of last week's program?
Yes, I would, especially in a topic that's a bit hard to follow like this one.
Well, we're following.
I hope it is. Well, we continued the discussion in the second segment of the topic of abrogation in the Quran. We focused last time on the verses which may implicitly imply or relate to abrogation, especially in chapter 13 and chapter 16. And we indicated that by analyzing those verses, they do not necessarily give an absolute or conclusive evidence of abrogation within the Quran, but they may indicate supersession of message of one prophet of the previous prophets. We discussed some of the views about abrogation within the Quran and how they developed. And we indicated that some writers went to one extreme of exaggeration or the other. We focused our discussion last time on one of those extremes that went too far in abrogation, or claiming there are so many verses in the Quran that has been abrogated. And we indicated that they dealt with so many verses that they even subdivided them into three categories. One category is the verses in the Quran that has been abrogated by way of injunction, but they're still part of the text. Those that has been abrogated both in terms of injunction and recitation, and those that has been abrogated from the text, but the rule is still applicable. And in our discussion of the second and third categories in particular, we gave a number of reasons why the reports cannot be accepted, both on the basis of the lack of sufficient historicity or authenticity in a serious and important matter like that pertains to the content of the Quran. And we said that the stories or reports are less than what is minimally required to accept abrogation. And also, by analyzing the style of these verses, we saw it's quite different from the language of the Quran that's familiar to anyone, as literalists also confirmed, and that sometimes even like the verse about adultery seemed to be contradictory to the spirit of Islamic law, which doesn't base the punishment on age, but rather on whether or not the person was married, to determine whether it's adultery technically or fornication, in which case the punishment is different.
I see. Well, thank you for bringing about the three types of abrogation, because this is one thing I wanted to ask you last week's program, but we ran out of time. But you touched upon the second and the third type of abrogation, but you left the first one out, and maybe I can bring you right back to it, and you can give us examples of this type and tell us if it's acceptable or not.
Okay. Actually, I prefer to deal with the second and third first by process of elimination. I think the first one, there are scholars who feel that it is not really problematic. That is to say that there are some verses which are there in the Quran in our hands today, which was revealed for a certain stage, so the injunction was applicable to that stage, but later on there was modification of that injunction based on the same reason that we gave last time, that to change people from the way they used to live to the state of true Islam, especially in matters of behavior and habits, it required some gradualness in legislation. So that one is not problematic. However, even in that acceptable category, there have been some exaggeration. Some writers even went as far as saying that there is a total of 565 verses in the Quran.
Oh my God.
That has been abrogated. But further and careful research showed that with the exception of very, very few verses, all the verses they refer to has really nothing to do with abrogation or modification of injunction, but rather that they are dealing with different aspects of the same problem, and as such they are more of complementary verses really, rather than one abrogating the other. The great majority of them, almost all except for very, very few.
Well, it may help our viewers, and me for that matter, if you gave us a few examples to illustrate your point.
Okay. In the Quran, for example, we find that there are several verses that deal with charity and encouraging person to look after the poor, and to especially people who have farms, that they should pay something to the poor at the time when they reap the fruits. There is also strong commendation in the Quran, as we find in chapter 2, verse 215, about kindness to needy relatives and charity to them. Now, many scholars have classified all of these verses as abrogated. Why? Because they say all of these were abrogated by the verse in the Quran which required Muslim to pay zakah. Zakah is the regular enforceable minimum charity that one has to pay.
Okay.
Now, the fact of the matter is that there is no abrogation here. Why? They are dealing with two different things. The verse that speaks about the minimal amount that you have to pay by way of regular charity or zakah, which is enforceable by the state, is dealing only with the mandatory part. But as we all know from the teaching of Islam, you are required also beyond the minimum to try your best also to help the poor in addition, on top of that. So there's absolutely no conflict between these two verses. There's no abrogation, because one of them deal with the compulsory part, another deal with the optional part by way of exhortation to do more good. Another example, I'm trying to be brief because there are numerous verses that relate to the same topics. I'm just trying to classify them together. Numerous verses in the Quran, for example, talks about being patient in the face of the persecution of the unbelievers, refraining from any aggressive act or response. And some scholars said that these verses were later abrogated by what they call Ayat al-Saif, the verse which allowed Muslims to carry arms and defend themselves and resist the tyranny. Again, to say that this is a matter of abrogation is not totally right. Why? Because to start with, the idea of patience even in the hope that the persecutor might reform his ways is still applicable. In other words, to teach the person to refrain himself from aggressive motives is still valid and has nothing to contradict with the notion that in some situations you may have to carry arms and defend yourself. See what I mean? On the other hand, one can also understand these verses in terms of the stages in which the Muslim community evolved. The initial verses that asked Muslims to totally refrain and to be patient in the face of all that persecution was a situation where they were very few, they were very weak, they were unable to defend themselves, and as such to carry arms at that time would have been suicidal, would have not led them anywhere, and they needed this training also on the strain. When they migrated to Medina, they became strong enough, they had more people entering into the fold of Islam. They were able at that time to stop the kind of persecution of other Muslims and to stand against the attacks of the unbelievers. And as such, there is not really abrogation as much as you might say teaching for a stage which is still applicable until today if Muslims are facing the same situation. In other words, even in the 20th century, a situation where a few Muslims as a minority in a different or un-Islamic society, if they are persecuted severely, they can't resist, so they have to teach refrain and patience. So it doesn't mean that it's totally abrogated at all. Also, in the Quran, concerning the inheritance, the law of inheritance. One verse in the Quran, for example, says that if some of the relatives or people who are poor attended or were present at the time when the estate of the deceased is divided or distributed among the legitimate heirs, that you should give them something of that. Some scholars said that this was abrogated by the specific verses in the Quran which have already determined which share goes to which relative depending on the degree of relatedness to the deceased. But again, with further examination, it appears that the verse in the Quran that determined the specific shares, it talks about the legitimate heirs, those who are legally entitled to a share. Whereas the first verse is basically a sort of exhortation of voluntary donation with the approval of all heirs to some of the poor and needy who might be present at the time of division. You see the point? In other words, one of them is voluntary, one of them is the legal part. So there's no contradiction, there's no abrogation. Actually, they supplement each other. I'll give you another example that some Orientalists, as mentioned by Dr. Khalifa, like Hughes, for example, have confused. And that relates to the right of the widow. On one hand, the Quran mentions in chapter 2, in verse 234, that a widow whose husband died should wait for 4 months and 10 days. On the other hand, they say that in verse 240 there is a mention of 1 year. And again, some people would wonder, is there any inconsistency there, or is there any abrogation? Some said abrogation. The fact of the matter is that there is neither inconsistency nor abrogation, but both verses, or each verse, deal with a different aspect of the rights and guarantees of protection of the widow. The first one, that says that the widow should wait for 4 months and 10 days, deal with the matter of marriage. In other words, it's unlawful for a woman whose husband dies to get married before the elapse of 4 months and 10 days. Some of the reasons of that we discussed in the social system of Islam, but basically to recognize the right of those who are deceased and respect for his family, but above all to ascertain whether she's pregnant from him or not, so that if she happened to get a child, the father and the lineage of the child would be well known. So that deals with this. Whereas the other verse, that is verse 240 in chapter 2, deals with another aspect of protection of the widow. And basically it says that they can wait for 1 year in a sense that they are entitled to stay in the house of their husbands for a year, if they choose to. They are guaranteed that year. But the verse says also, if they prefer to leave before that time, for example, to get married after the 4 months and 10 days, they may do so. There's no problem with this. But if she chooses to have this guarantee or protection, nobody can drive her out of the household of her husband, deceased husband, for a year. I went into some detail in this because, like I said, this is one of the areas where some Orientalists have pointed to, and perhaps their statement reflect their lack of understanding of the nature of the Islamic law and the variety of protections that these deal actually with different topics. I would recommend, however, to those who wish to have more details, and I think I have given enough examples, but those who really want to go in greater depth in this, there is an interesting book by Sheikh Abdul Muta'al Al-Jabri. It's titled La Naskha Fil Quran. And most of his book actually deals with these claimed abrogated verses and shows that actually they are dealing with different aspects of the same problem, not really abrogating one another. But the basic point I'm just trying to make is that what many people, even in the first category, which is acceptable even, claim that there are certain verses in the Quran which are there still, that has been superseded by others, most of what they said is not really relevant to abrogation.
Dr. Jamal, it seems to me that so far our discussion has focused on one extreme approach towards abrogation. Mm-hmm. Now let me take you all the way to the other side of the tide and talk about the other extreme, and why is it regarded as such?
Well, the other extreme, if I recollect what we mentioned earlier, that one extreme exaggerated too much, and while maybe a few verses might have been accepted as superseded by others for good reason, the other went to the other extreme by mixing abrogation or naskh with something called al-bada. Al-bada means that God or Allah changes his mind if something new appears to him, some new information or some new wisdom he discovers, so he changes his mind. Those who claim that were a group of people who were totally outside of the bounds of Islam, known as al-Rafida, and their leader al-Thaqafi accepted this notion that seemed to have been adopted from previous theology, not from Islamic theology or Islamic law at all. And perhaps we'll get into the discussion of that position, but basically it's a sort of like God discovering new things. But there are those also who went to the other extreme and said that there could be no abrogation whatsoever, because abrogation is bada, means that God changes his mind, and that's not right to say. And some of them try to explain that, or most of the abrogation, as takhsis. Takhsis means to specify the scope of implementation, not to cancel or to replace an injunction. One of those scholars who adopted that second approach is known as Abu Muslim al-Isfahani. Now, both of them, we can say, are wrong, because first of all, to say that God changes his mind is blasphemy, as we indicated in a previous program in the series, because that assumes that God lacks knowledge or lacks wisdom and just discovers something. That's totally contrary to the whole theme in the Quran and the attributes of Allah in the Quran. So that's totally outside the boundaries of Islam. But on the other hand, to claim also, like al-Isfahani did, that there is no abrogation but there is only specification, is not quite correct technically. I know this might get slightly technical, but maybe I should explain it in a simple term by saying that when an injunction is specified, it means that the same injunction is there, it has not been abrogated, but all you're saying is that make sure that the implementation is restricted to that scope. Example: a very famous short chapter in the Quran is known as Al-Asr, and it says إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَفِي خُسْرٍ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّلَحَاتِ. It says that mankind or humankind is at loss, and then it says except those who believed and did good deeds and exhorted each other in goodness and exhorted each other in perseverance. Now, there is some exception there, or takhsis, because in the beginning the statement is too general. It says mankind is at loss, and if you say mankind, that each man and woman, everybody is at loss. So the takhsis here says now except for those who, and then it gives the description, believe and good deeds and all that. So that's takhsis, but still humankind is at loss in general except for this. But that's different from abrogation, because abrogation means that mankind is not at loss, for example, to say something different from that. So this is one confusion between takhsis or specification and supersession. It has not been
supersession. It's a clear difference between the two.
Exactly, because in one case one is superseded, in the other case the other is just specified. It's not superseded, but there is additional explanation of how it should be implemented, or to whom that should be applied, or who should be exempted from that general rule. This is one aspect of those, you know, extremism in terms of superstition.
Now, in view of our discussion so far, we discussed different aspects of abrogation. What aspects of these are acceptable?
Well, what is acceptable is to think of abrogation as the term that I tried to use in the first program in this section, more as supersession in a sense of superstition, that something supersedes the other. Basically, that Allah, in His eternal knowledge and wisdom, chooses what to reveal to different prophets throughout history, or even within the Quran itself, in the 23 years in which the Quran was revealed. So He chooses the timing of certain injunctions. So He may reveal one injunction at one time, which is suitable for the circumstances in that particular stage in the development of the Muslim community. And then later on, He decides, and that knowledge again is known to Him in advance, that it is time now that they move on to another thing that He planned, you know, for them to move into. Just a matter of timing, with all prior knowledge available to Him, with all wisdom behind that timing already at hand. I'll give you two examples of this to illustrate it. One is a more general example, the other is specifically within the Quran. Take one general example that some people have gravely misunderstood. Some people would say, all right, in the Quran there is a mention of the story of Prophet Abraham, and they say there is some kind of contradictory injunctions given to him. On one hand, Abraham was told to sacrifice his only son, and according to Islamic tradition, his only son for 14 years was Ishmael, not Isaac. So to sacrifice his only son, Ishmael. Now, so there is one injunction, sacrifice your son. But then it says later on, when he just began to do this, God ordained him to stop that and to sacrifice a ram instead of his son. So they say here two different commands, you know. But if you really look at it, there is nothing here that remotely even relates to God changing His mind, as some Orientalists concluded. Absolutely irrelevant to changing mind. Because the fact of the matter is not that God wanted him to sacrifice Ishmael and then later on had sympathy with Ishmael and said, no, sacrifice a lamb. A ram. Exactly. Right. You're right. In the plan of God, God never wanted Abraham to sacrifice his son. There is no sense of killing your son. But it was, like he said, a test of faith of Prophet Abraham. So He gave him that command at one stage to test his obedience. And when Abraham showed that obedience and love of the Creator, that he's even willing to sacrifice his own son, then the other plan came into question, or the other stage came into question. God said, all right, now here is my real plan. You sacrifice the ram instead of your son. There is no changing of mind here. Another example we mentioned also in a previous program, and actually more than one occasion, because we talked about it also in the lawful and unlawful under moral teaching of Islam, is the prohibition of intoxicants. Again, as a habit that people were used to, the Quran did not come from the first day and say, stop drinking, you know, but we find that it's gone through stages. In chapter 16 in the Quran, verse 67, it made a contrast between sakaran and rizqan hasan, and between things that are intoxicant and things that are good, by way of contrast. And then in chapter 2, verse 219, it says there is good and evil in intoxicant, or there might be benefit, but there is evil, and the evil is greater than the benefit. So people reduced. And then later on, in chapter 4, verse 43, it says, don't come to the prayer while you're intoxicated or under the influence of alcohol or other intoxicants. And then later on, in chapter 2, verse 219, the prohibition was categorical and final. Again, it doesn't mean that, in a sense, one abrogated the other or removing it altogether, because until today, it is still valid that you can't go to prayers under intoxicant. But it went beyond that to say that not only for the prayer purposes, but for good. Don't drink, period.
I see.
And the validity of many of which still holds. I'd like to add just one comment here, that when you talk about abrogation, even in that sense, or superstition, there is no superstition in fundamental beliefs, no superstition or abrogation in fundamental aspect of morality, fundamentals, or basis of worship, or basis of dealings. The basic principles can never undergo this kind of change, but it's a sort of, you know, other legislative matters that went with it.
Now, in our discussion, we talked about these different categories, and we've quote-unquote mentioned the acceptable category of abrogation. Now, is there any information about maybe the approximate number of verses in this particular category?
Well, according to one great scholar of the Quran, we mentioned his name before, Jalaluddin As-Suyuti, he says that actually it boils down to 21 verse. Of course, that's far, you know, from the 565, which some people exaggerated without really justification. And even As-Suyuti himself exempted two verses out of these 21, known as the verses pertaining to taking permission, istidhan, and the subdivision of the estate of the deceased. So that came down to 19. According to some contemporary scholars, even like Dr. Subhi Salih, whose name we mentioned before also, he said that if these are scrutinized further, probably the abrogated, quote-unquote, or verses that were superseded by other verses in the Quran will not exceed about 10 of them. And we have already explained before that these 10 even shows basically the sort of gradual nature of the legislation, or how it moved from one stage to the other. Let me give you a few examples of some of the verses that Jalaluddin As-Suyuti mentioned, which seem to indicate that even the term abrogation might be too much for it, even though there is some kind of supersession. In chapter 2 in the Quran, in verse 115, it says, وَلِلَّهِ الْمَشْرِقُ وَالْمَغْرِبُ فَأَيْنَمَا تُوَلُّوا فَثَمَّ وَجْهُ اللَّهِ. It says basically that unto Allah belongs the east and the west, and whenever or wherever you turn your face, there is the presence of Allah. On the other hand, some believe that this was superseded by the verse in chapter 2, that's verse 44. It says that whenever you pray, فَوَلِّ وَجْهَكَ شَطْرَ الْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ, you direct your face towards the Kaaba, that's the sacred house. Now, while it might sound different, that on one hand it says you can pray, or wherever you turn your face, you know, there's the presence of Allah. The other one says you have to specifically turn your face towards the Kaaba. In fact, as some scholars explained it, that even the first one, the first verse that was believed to be superseded by some scholars, is still applicable. How? There is no difference among jurists that people, for example, when they are traveling on board a ship or plane or missile for that matter, whatever, spaceship, they can direct their face to the best of their ability, but if the camel or ship or plane changes direction, they don't have to change direction. So still, for necessity like that, you can, again, whenever you turn your face, there is the presence of Allah. Okay? Some of them even say that especially for voluntary prayers, even voluntary prayers, if one is traveling on for riding a camel, for example, or a horse, he can just pray in any direction. Whereas, under normal circumstances, when the person is resident, when he's able to determine the direction of the Kaaba, the required prayer, he should direct himself towards the Kaaba. So like I said, even those 10 that As-Suyuti mentioned does not mean necessarily that one of them was cancelled as such.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Jamal. Our cameraman indicates our time is up, and so it is. We thank you all for joining us, and we hope to see you here next week in Islam in Focus. From all of us here, Assalamu Alaikum.
أشهد أن محمد